Your city, our city. Because we live here too.
Cambridge 105.
And welcome to Flavour with me, Matt Bentman, Ruth Reyes and Alan Alder. And many thanks to Neil Whiteside for the last 2 hours.
Today on Flavour, we welcome back Gigi Perry from Pembroke College, who will talk about her food writing. Nazima and Pierre from Franglais Kitchen will be introducing our new feature, Spice of the Month. Tom Lewis will be talking about the vital task of selecting the right wine to go with your food, or possibly the right food to go with your wine. And at the end of the programme, we'll give you an update of forthcoming supper clubs and pop-up restaurants, along with other food and drink news.
But the main item today is something that's often in the national news. There was a House of Commons debate about it recently, and a row about it on a Channel 5 programme this week. It's food poverty. How much of an issue is it in Cambridge? We know there's a food bank and food cycle, but why do people need them in this comparatively wealthy city with low unemployment? In fact, Cambridge is set to have 17% of its children living in poverty. What we found out is pretty shocking.
Last week, before the Channel 5 programme about food poverty aired, Alan went to speak with a professional who works with families who are experiencing difficulties. We have not used her real name and not mentioned the area of Cambridge she works in to ensure confidentiality. To break that would be to breach the trust she has built up with families. Alan began by asking about the effect of food poverty on children.
In what way can you see the effect on children? Does it affect things like when they're at school? Does it affect behaviour, concentration, that sort of thing?
I think it affects all of those things. If you can imagine when you're at your most hungry and your stomach's rumbling and actually painful because you've not eaten for several hours, if not days, you'll probably find that you can't concentrate on anything or think of anything but food.
Are there children who haven't eaten for days?
I think there will be significant children who certainly will maybe only eating one small bit of food within a 24-hour period. Whether that's at home or at school. There are certainly children that go through that.
And this obviously is related to poverty. Mm. But if children come from families that don't have a lot of money, aren't they entitled to a free school meal?
Not always. It goes with certain benefits. You can apply for free school meals, and certain ones it doesn't apply, even though the level of income actually may well be around the same mark. It's a juggling act, actually, as to what you're able to apply for, depending on which benefit you're getting.
Yeah.
And often some people who are working several hours to actually benefit themselves and their family can actually lose out on the school meal because they're then not entitled to that particular benefit that accesses it.
Right. Well, I can't imagine going for several days with only small meals. So how does it affect children?
I mean, I could speak from personal experience. I grew up in a family where my mother lived on a very low trust fund, so actually completely different to the normal picture of families living on benefits in council houses. It was a privately rented house. We just had a low income, as my mother had mental health difficulties, which meant she didn't work. And certainly we would go 24 hours at least without food. When food did come, we didn't cook, so it was a chunk of bread and a hunk of cheese. And there were many days I went to school without breakfast at all. And other times it would swing between going to the sort of local bakery shop and breaking currant bun into four and having a quarter of that. So when I look back at my childhood, actually a lot of my memories are based around when I did get food and the sort of pleasure of eating, which is something that's followed me into adulthood. But actually, how do you concentrate if your stomach's rumbling and you're feeling faint? And that's something teachers report, children actually fainting in class because they haven't eaten, falling asleep in class.
What? You're talking about nowadays?
Yes,
you're not talking about when you were at...
nowadays. I think it's 30% of teachers are reporting that children are facing more poverty and coming in not having had breakfast. It's a huge proportion. I think we think it's very small, but it's not.
Right. So if you haven't had breakfast and you're not entitled for a free school meal,
and you're not eating until you get home, and then hopefully your parents do have food, or parent, as in most cases, when you get home, if they've got the food there then.
So does it affect children's behaviour in the sense that maybe they become more tired?
Mm.
When children are tired, does their behaviour just become sort of rather passive, or are they roused to anger quickly?
Yeah,
or
I think it could be both, actually. Right. I mean, I think if you're starving hungry, there's a sort of flight or freeze instinct, really. Some children, I think, crash and, as we say, fall asleep, they faint, they pass out, they have no energy at all. And I think others do become angry, and it's that sort of aggressive, you know, I need food. And then you get bad behaviour within the class, which I think can then be mistaken for other issues, such as maybe the parenting. Whereas actually, maybe you have a fantastic parent behind that child, but apparently you can't afford to feed them.
What do people do then? They go to a food bank.
Mm. I think that the people who are brave go to food banks because there's a huge loss of dignity with people who use them. I think we've managed in some respects to lose the stigma of the sort of free school dinner, you've got the green ticket. But I think with food banks there is still that stigma. People are worried about bumping into people that they may know there. And they're worried about being seen, you know, at the food bank itself. So I think there's a huge loss of dignity, and actually for a parent to get to a point where they feel they can ask. And then as a professional, you're only allowed to give so many vouchers, so then you have the issue of them asking and sometimes you having to say no.
How many vouchers are you allowed to give?
It's 2 in 6 months and a maximum of 3.
Okay, but if you haven't got enough money to eat, then doesn't that affect you every day rather than twice every 6 months?
It does. It does indeed.
So what do people do?
They go hungry.
Well, that seems incredible.
Yes, I totally agree with you. It's a horrendous situation where you've got parents who can't feed their children. And when you think of it on the basic lines of as parents, where we provide love, food and shelter and clothing as a sort of basic 4 items, and you're saying that you can't provide the very thing which you know is sustaining life.
Mm.
So the mental stress on not only the parent but the children as well becomes huge, right, and intolerable, really.
When people go to food banks, some of the food that get them from there needs to be cooked.
Mm.
But if you can't afford food, I'm wondering if you can afford the electricity or the gas that you need to cook it with.
Often not, or it's a priority, so actually you'll have families not using electricity for a lot of the day, certainly not with heating. I visit a lot of cold houses where I stay in my coat because I'm cold, because actually they're saving up to be able to cook in the evening. But I agree with you that there is an issue with actually are you able to afford the electricity to cook the food on. And I think another issue with food banks is actually there are a lot of people with very strict religious beliefs who can't eat certain foods, and I myself have had families who've actually given me a bag of food back that they got from a food bank because it was items that they were unable to eat due to religious beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
So there's also not only a sort of indignity about asking in the first place and then making that visit, mm-hmm. but there's then an indignity about actually opening the bag and finding that some of the food you can't eat.
Mm-hmm.
And how must that feel to a parent who's not only gone through the embarrassing experience of using the food bank, to then actually realise that actually they as a parent can't even feed the children the foods that are so crucial to their religious upbringing.
Mm-hmm. And do people who find themselves in the position of not having enough food, the popular view is it's families who perhaps are badly organised, or is that fair, or does it cover a wider range than that?
I think in my experience, there's a very limited few, I would say, where it might be bad organisation, either financially. But I think most of them, I mean, it's a very humiliating experience to be given free. I mean, it's a big red voucher that you're given, and it's you have to take it somewhere and hand it in. And I think that's a very humiliating experience to go through. So I feel there's not a lot of people, I would say, using food banks who don't actually need to do so.
Yeah.
And I think, coming back to your earlier point, I suppose, about the what do you do when you've run out of your vouchers, actually if your children are starving, what you do is become quite crafty and approach maybe certain different people who work with families asking for vouchers, in the knowledge that information isn't always shared, so you can end up with more than your share of vouchers. And I believe that most of those people have done that through desperation rather than any sort of desire to to have more than their share. They're hungry.
You mentioned before about people's reluctance to go to food banks, partly because they don't want other people to see them doing that. I wonder, do the children feel stigmatised, or is it generally not that well known by other children who's needed to go?
I can't say that's something that I would know about. However, most often they're open in the daytime, so I think there is a possibility for the children actually not to know. But I guess in a house where you don't have a lot of food, if there's a sudden influx of food, you're going to ask where it came from.
And we mentioned before the fact that for some children, at least, there are free school meals, and that must be incredibly important to them. But there aren't free school meals during school holidays.
No, and I think that's a big issue, because if on one level you're saying this family need to be given a free meal, you know, and it's a nice filling meal with a nice pudding, you're saying that they need that in the daytime, then actually every single school holiday, we're effectively saying, but you can get by without it. And when you think of a six-week summer holiday, when those children are far more active and then eating a lot more because of that, I think that's a huge time of stress for a lot of parents. And you will get parents who are saving up all year round as they go, sort of hiding food under the bed and in corners where children hopefully won't find it during the term time, so they have a bit extra. And you actually just have parents where that child misses that meal, so they just don't have that main meal in the day. 6 weeks is a long time for that to happen.
Yes, 1 week is a long time for that to happen, I would have said. Yeah.
I think it's just extremely important that people realise that actually the majority of people using food banks and free school meals are genuinely struggling.
And you've seen this for yourself through visits.
I have. I mean, I deal with many, many families, and actually the mental destruction it can do to a parent, and then the knock-on effect of the parenting and the chaos within the family of not having a basic survival need, which is food, and to be hungry, not only for yourself, but then for your children as well. It leads to then mental health problems anyway.
So, I mean, I know generalisation is difficult and actually not always useful, but in general, how do the parents come across to you?
I think most of the parents that I meet where there's real poverty and concerns of actually not being able to provide food, most of them are depressed. Their self-esteem is very, very low. Their confidence in their own parenting ability, which actually may be gold standard parenting, but actually if you can't afford food, you can't afford food. So actually everything in that family drops. It's if you've got a parent who has no confidence in themselves, actually as a human being, and an ability to be able to feed others. And certainly for mothers, you know, the function of mothers is you feed your baby. If you can't do that, actually that's a sort of very raw emotion to carry. That you can't feed your children. So you have a parent, and it's not just mothers, single fathers and joint parents. Actually, the mental health will have plummeted quite low. And then, of course, that has a knock-on effect for the children who then aren't parented correctly, because actually often the parents are starving themselves. Behaviour can go awry, and experience in school. So you get a sort of a global family dysfunction, really, all down to not being able to eat.
Where does the poverty come from? The statistics from the Trussell Trust who run food banks suggest that nearly 30% of food bank vouchers are given because there's a time gap, there's a gap before benefits are provided. But it sounds to me as if you're talking about families who are suffering more long-term than that.
Yes, I mean, I think there are those cases. It takes around 6 weeks for an average benefit application, and in that time I have lots of families who say, I have nothing, I have no money, and everything just goes into arrears, rent, everything within that six-week period. And food sort of does the same, and I think a lot of people rely on neighbours and friends to give them money to help them through that period. It's a sort of community sense. But I think there are an awful lot of people living in general food poverty who actually being hungry is just a norm.
I'm still wondering about why people end up not being able to afford food. Okay, I can understand there's time. But I mean, are they generally not in work, or are they on 0 hours contracts and not getting enough work?
Often not in work, but actually incredibly some are in work, definitely trying to better themselves and raise themselves out of benefits. But there are certain loopholes, I think, in the benefits systems, where when you get, you might be working just over the boundary of not getting benefits, but actually, so you lose your benefit trying to improve yourself and your family's and future prospects, but you lose the very benefit that actually you lose more benefit in some respects than you're earning. So for a lot of families, it is actually more financially beneficial for them to stay on their benefits, unless you can take quite a leap in earnings, really, and sort of jump that gap, then that's where you get a problem. And I see a lot of parents who are working, desperately trying to get themselves sort of up and stable, who then become not entitled to the benefits that get them the additional money or food as and when they need it.
And if you need to find work, but as you just said, your mental state isn't as good as it was.
Yes, and that's a big problem. Several of the families I work with, the parents aren't working because they're signed off with depression, and it's exceptionally hard to get yourself out of that rut, especially if that struggle is going to be an uphill climb. It's very hard.
So what was it like for you growing up with not enough food?
I think my whole world revolved around food. Looking back, a lot of my memories are looking down at plates of food at school, and so this obviously had a deep impact on me when I was given a meal. And I think I was one of the few children at school who adored school meals of the time, because to me it was like a banquet. And we sort of would very erratically have food, which I think is the case for a lot of people, actually. And it was sort of poor education in food for my mother as well. She didn't know how to cook, didn't cook. So a lot of what we ate was cold, and like I say, so a hunk of bread and a hunk of cheese and an apple. Which nutritionally, you know, actually may be okay for that one meal, but certainly there were days when we just didn't eat, and there are photographs of myself and my siblings with sort of distended stomachs, which I know is something that's now being seen in schools, sort of actual visible evidence of malnutrition.
Yes.
And I think when I look back, you know, I certainly wasn't thinking about how I was doing in school. I was thinking about when I was going to get food.
And as an adult, how do you see food now? Are you more interested in it than the average adult, or what?
I think I am. I have quite a distorted sense of food. I've always struggled with my weight a bit, sort of going up and down. And I think, for me, I do have a sense of, and it's sort of almost a family joke, really, as a way of coping with it, I guess, is that we sort of, you know, you if you see food, you eat it, because you never know when you're going to get any more. And that's something that all sort of my three siblings and myself share.
Even now?
Yes, even now as adults. It's something you have to sort of train your brain out of thinking as, well, I do now have access to food.
Yeah.
And I think you then do generationally pass part of that on to your children. So I spend an awful lot of my time, and always have done, I have a lot of children, teaching them about food and nutrition and what's healthy and how to trust when you're hungry and not hungry. And I think it does unfortunately pass generation to generation. It leads to unhealthy eating patterns.
If people want to give to food banks, what do they do? Where do they go?
You'll notice in most supermarkets, often at the end of the checkout, you'll find that there's a box that very clearly will say food bank on it. Often these boxes, I've noticed, tend to have additional carrier bags stacked next to it, where people have been so generous it's actually overflowed the box. And often on them they ask for people to just put in a can a week or something each week as they pass. And it's through the generosity of people doing that that all of these thousands of people nationally are fed.
Yeah.
So I would recommend for anybody to do it. And I myself occasionally just go through my cupboards, and if we're not using things and they're still in date, I will take a bag with me and put it in shopping, sort of bring it from home.
Okay, I can understand things like tins are very easy, but can you put fresh fruit in? Perishable?
I believe not. I believe it is things that are...
Because it makes me wonder about the balanced diet. Are people getting enough vitamin, vitamin C particularly?
I think it's an interesting question, because actually the things that are most expensive are your fruit and your vegetables. And certainly I know when I was a single parent, that was something I struggled was to put vast amounts of fruit that obviously were fantastic for children to eat on the table. and it was something I always tried to prioritise, and we just had a lot more pastas and filling foods. But it's so worrying as a parent not to be able to give vegetables and fruit.
Yeah.
I think there's been a slight issue in with the whole five a day and people believing that it has to be fresh, because actually some of that can be tinned. So I think what happened was we had a great belief that actually tinned fruit and vegetables were not good enough. So actually people didn't buy that at all. So then instead of, if you couldn't have fresh fruit and veg, you got no fruit and veg. Whereas actually, if you can't, tinned is part of your five a day and it does still work.
So I'm not sure the levels of vitamin C are as high, because it does get destroyed quite easily.
But if you're talking about nothing,
it's still something.
That was a professional who works with families who are in difficulties in one part of Cambridge. What's your reaction to what she said? Do let us know. You can email us on flavour@cambridge105.fm. I was interested in finding more about who is affected by food poverty, so I visited Helen Crowther, who works at the Citizens Advice Bureau in Devonshire Road. I began by asking if food poverty is much of an issue.
Statistically, is it an issue in Cambridge? Cambridge is, you know, has the reputation of being a wealthy city, and visitors to Cambridge will see that. So is it much of an issue in Cambridge?
Yeah, well, our research says that basically food poverty has risen the most in the wealthiest counties, and it really has risen in Cambridge. In fact, Cambridge City Food Bank have found that between 2012 and 2013, it rose by about 115%, like the number of people coming to them for food parcels, which is massive.
I don't understand why food poverty is going up more quickly in the wealthier parts of the country.
That's because living costs tend to be more expensive, so everything's more expensive, including rent, and also food costs.
And rents in Cambridge are quite high.
Yeah, they're incredibly high.
That means that people haven't got as much money left for food then.
Yeah, that's right. Because obviously a priority bill is rent, because otherwise you'll get your house repossessed or you'll get a possession order and have to leave. So
if you're talking about getting house repossessed, are some people who are in food poverty, they're homeowners, are they?
Some of them are, yeah. It's not just, I mean, there's a bit of an assumption that it tends to be people who are unemployed and on benefits, but actually people who are in work do receive some benefits as well. So while it does tend to be people who tend to be food poor are those on benefits, obviously because they have a low income, actually Trussell Trust found that the largest number of people going to them were people on low incomes. I think that might be to do with the increase in zero-hour contracts and really quite uncertain income coming in.
Yeah. OK, but some people are homeowners or mortgage payers.
Yeah, they could be, and they could have. I mean, times are hard for everyone, and it's really unpredictable when something goes wrong and when someone might lose their job. So, yeah, they could be homeowners.
Yes.
Some of them are.
When people come to the Citizens Advice Bureau concerned about the fact that they can't afford food, shall we say, what sort of state are they in? Are they...
Well, desperate, obviously. It's the last resort, because people do tend to do whatever they can to go to family and friends and ask for money. So really coming to us is a real last resort. Some mothers as well go without food themselves in order to be able to feed their children. So really, at Citizens Advice, we want people to come in earlier on, so when they start to have money problems and debt problems, that we can help people with to prevent like this emergency happening.
Yeah. So the people who come in, do you know either from your own observations or from what GPs might say, are there any cases of malnutrition developing?
It's not something we measure in that way. But I know that there have been an increased number of people going to hospital for malnutrition cases over the past year.
Can you give me some examples of the situation people are in?
Yeah, well, recently a hospital nurse, so someone in work who actually wasn't claiming any benefits, she had a number of debts and one of them was rent arrears. She came in to us for support and we'd agreed how to pay the rent arrears back with with the council, so that was all fine. However, she had payday loans as well. So the payday lenders didn't stop the continuous payment authority, which means that they could take money directly from her bank account. So they took basically all her wages for that month, so she was left with £22 to live on. And also she had like a repossession order made against her, and no money obviously to buy food, because £22 for the whole month. So it's these kind of cases. Another man was on, a young man was on a zero-hour contract, and he found out from his employer that there wouldn't be any more hours for him. So he went on Job Seeker's Allowance, but actually it would take 2 weeks for Job Seeker's Allowance to be reinstated for him, basically. So he absolutely had no money for 2 weeks to pay for food. So it really is quite desperate situations. With a hospital nurse, she could have come in to us and... like, we could have helped her figure out a way to sort out her debts and stop the continuous payment authorities to begin with, and then it wouldn't have become so desperate. And with the young man as well, we could have helped him maybe get a benefit advance from the job centre before his proper benefits were instated, so that he had some money to live off.
The people you've mentioned, do they, or anybody else for that matter, they have families, say, young children?
Yeah, they do. Oftentimes they do have quite young families. Yeah. And as I said, they often go without themselves in order to feed their children. Cambridge City Food Bank, after single people being affected by food poverty, I think there's about 58%. Families are the next largest household to be affected by food poverty. So it's 15%, so it's significantly less, but a significantly high number in figures.
There's been things in the papers recently about the fact that some of the food that people get from food banks need to be cooked, but some people can't afford the gas or the electricity.
Yeah, that is a real issue, especially we get a lot of homeless people, obviously, who are without food and haven't eaten well for days. And they come to us and we can give them a food voucher in order to go and get a food parcel. But yeah, without being able to cook the food, that's incredibly difficult for people, obviously. Mm-hmm. So there are places like, I know St Paul's on a Saturday does a hot meal.
Ruth, St Paul's on a Saturday, you've been there a couple of times recently, haven't you? It's run by Food Cycle. What's it like?
It's actually really nice. It's a really lovely atmosphere. Not what I was expecting anyways. It's very open, very friendly, very homely. And it's really nice. Yeah, right. It's table service.
Good atmosphere.
Yeah, really good one.
Okay, good food?
Yeah, the food's great, actually. I had a vegetable stew and some banana bread.
Yeah, you were working there, weren't you? You weren't.
I didn't know. They didn't need any volunteers. Right. I just went to see what it was like.
Yeah, okay. And did you speak to any of the clients there or the customers there? Did anybody say why they were there?
Yeah, I spoke to a couple of people. One was a formerly homeless man. It's not one that is currently, but very recently just got a job and very low income, can't really afford food. And this is his one hot meal a week. But I think what really struck me is that one of the reasons why he went was not just that, but also because he found it a good halfway house between being alone and socially and isolated into re-entering society, because the volunteers are really good about talking to people, and like I said, it's very homely, very open, and everyone listens.
Yeah. Where do they get their food from at Food Cycle?
They get it from Sainsbury's on a Friday night and also from Lensfield Road Farm Shop, and they get it using a bicycle service, which I think adds to the whole the whole entity of Food Cycle.
Right. And if you want to volunteer, what would you do?
You just go to their website, which is foodcycle.org.uk, and see if they need any volunteers. I know that they often need them during term time, during school terms when they're off. What's it called? School holidays.
You remember them. Right, okay. Food Cycle sounds good for lots of reasons, but I wondered about those people who rely on it or on food banks to get their food. For food banks, you must have a voucher, and you can have two in 6 months, three in an emergency, So I asked Helen Crowther from Citizens Advice Bureau about this.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. People think that people can just go to food banks and it's a limitless resource, but obviously it depends on people's charity and goodwill. It's not a government, food banks aren't government agencies. Really, resources are scarce, which is why we can only give out so many food parcels. Mm. So after that, people are pretty stuck, which is why we get people to come to the CAB and give out food vouchers here, because we try and tackle the actual underlying issue that has caused them to need a food voucher in the first place. We give debt advice. We give the most comprehensive debt advice in the county. We have funding from the council to prevent homelessness, so to help people with increase their financial capability. We campaign against the government use of zero-hour contracts. We also try and promote credit unions to get people to save more so that they don't get into debt, and any unforeseen expenses that occur they can actually pay for.
And that was Helen Crowther of Citizens Advice Bureau. They do a lot of good work for the people of Cambridge. They are under some pressure, though, and new volunteers are always welcome. The sorts of things that need doing can range from social policy work, gathering evidence, advice work, and so on. There's an online form you can fill in, or you can phone Helen Walwork on Cambridge 222 681, or email helenw@cambridgecab.org.uk.
But how do we move from talking about people without enough to eat, or who can't feed their children, to features on the joys of fine food and wine? Food poverty is something we should know about, and we're not always given the full story by newspapers and television programmes. And we can help too, for example, by volunteering our time or giving food.
In Your Company is Cambridge 105's business programme, presented by me, Sam Davis. In Your Company captures the diversity of the Cambridge business scene by talking to not only the high-tech headline grabbers, but also the sole traders and the startups and the experts who can help us make sense of it. Listen to In Your Company at 3 p.m. on Saturday afternoons every fortnight. And podcasts of our shows are available on the Cambridge 105 website. Community radio in your city, Cambridge 105.
Parts of what we have broadcast today may come as a surprise to some listeners. It's not often you hear some of that information. We'll be very interested to hear your views. You can email us at flavour@cambridge105.fm.
Still to come, we have Tom Lewis talking about fine food and wine matches. Nazima and Pierre from Franglais Kitchen will bring the first of their Spice of the Month features, and we have lots of food and drink news for you. First, though, let's hear from Gigi Perry from Pembroke College. Gigi is now writing for Varsity on food matters, as she told Alan during the week.
When we last spoke, Gigi, you were writing for Cambridge Student, but
yes.
Now I see you in the pages of Varsity. Have you been bought out?
I'm lifestyle editor for Varsity. I have a really strong bias on food and drink, so I always make sure there's lots there. But we also have a little bit on fashion, beauty, and sort of fitness and health as well.
But what do you write about as far as food is concerned?
So food, I have my weekly recipe and weekly drink still. And then also if there's any sort of food trends. So my double page spread is all along a theme. So it was colour last week. You can get in obviously colourful food. And so I had a thing, it's like a layer cake that has 7 different layers of colours of cake. I can always get food in.
Yeah.
Yes.
And the recipes, where do these originate, and do you try them out?
Yeah, they're my recipes, so it's things that I'll do at home, and so I've taken the photographs for them as well, and same with the cocktails. And I like to have something so it's with a sort of student in mind, so there's never thousands of ingredients and different spices and herbs, but they're always flavourful. I bring in sort of Cambridge links, so I have a Cambridge Cosmopolitan, so it's blue, and things that, so for example, with cocktails, you don't need a cocktail shaker, you can do it in a jam jar. So it's things that is very accessible and not too oven based a lot of the time, because we don't have, most kitchens don't have ovens.
Yes, so actually it's useful not just for students, I think.
Yes, it's... Yeah.
And can non-university people have access to Varsity?
Yes, we're online, and I always tweet the link to the recipe, and so anyone can access it online. And there's lots of, it's, as it's a newspaper, there's lots of other sections as well. So we have fashion, sport, news, And Varsity is really fantastic because it links Cambridge, but there's also influences from the rest of the country as well in terms of news and comment.
Right. And how frequently is it published?
We have the print edition every 2 weeks, and online there's constantly new things going up.
Right,
all the
time. It's all just being updated.
Yeah, relevant.
But your food pieces presumably are fortnightly, are they? Or do you update those as well?
I do. I've just done a lime cheesecake has just gone up online, a ginger nut and lime cheesecake. Mm. And so something like when it was Chinese New Year, I did a sort of a feast to make for that. So that wasn't published in print, but it went up online. Because actually, interestingly, for students, online is much more widely read, and my friends who read it, they see it online rather than generally in print.
And do you know are you able to know how many people actually look at it online? Is there a
I think we do have a very high circulation rate. I think I'm not there, I may be wrong, but I think it's something like 5,000 to 6,000 people read Varsity, so it is widely read. And we have, so the print edition is available in all colleges, different faculties and departments, and so sort of the Arts Picture House as well, they have it. Because we sort of review local things as well, so it is relevant.
Yes,
I do read
really
it, actually.
It's really fantastic. I brought you a copy, actually.
Oh, thank you. Well, that's very kind. Why did you leave Cambridge Student, then?
It's a termly appointment.
I see.
And
right.
So I...
Because there's quite a few people who want to do it.
Yes.
And so it rotates regularly.
So you've got it for a term.
Thanks to Gigi Perry. And Gigi will return next time and will tell us about the work that goes into arranging the food for May Balls and June events.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
And we have a new feature coming to the programme. Well, it's on right now, in fact. It's Spice of the Month from Franglais Kitchen.
Right, Nazima, you're talking to us about which spice today?
So today we're going to talk about star anise. This is one of the Chinese five spices, classically. Star anise is a great way to add an oriental depth of flavour to sweet and savoury foods. It's a warming spice and has a licorice kind of smell, similar to aniseed and fennel.
And it's very attractive physically as well, isn't it?
Yes, it is indeed. It's actually in a star shape with eight sides to it. The seeds are on the inside, but the whole of the fruit, as it's a dried fruit, can actually be used for cooking. You can cook it in several ways. You can either use the whole star in a stew and plunge it into liquid, or you can actually grind it to end up with a powder, which you can marinate.
Well, you would grind the whole of the fruit, you wouldn't take the seeds out.
I grind the whole of the fruit. Right. If you want probably to be perfectionist, you can take the seed out, but the whole of the fruit has a flavour.
Yeah, cool. But it has a distinct flavour, and it has quite a strong flavour. Mm. So if you put it in stews, as you suggested, doesn't the stew start to taste of anise?
Not. It can be fairly subtle, and obviously you can adjust it to your taste. But in the same way that ginger and cinnamon, ground ginger and cinnamon, can be quite strong spices, it's just about a moderation.
And personal taste as well.
Some people say that if you put it in sparingly into something like a stew, it will enhance the meatiness of the meat, and you won't actually be able to taste it. Anise itself. Is that the case?
It's something that Heston Blumenthal has, often recommended in meat stocks and fish stocks. So, for example, we've done a dish with beef, an oxtail, where if you have a long stew and it gives a lovely depth of flavour, or if you wanted to do a stock and make a pho type Vietnamese type soup, then anise will be a good subtle thing. And if you just use it whole and take it out, it's not going to impart too much flavour to it.
Yeah, so if I can talk very quickly about those croquettes, they're made with oxtail and beef brisket, which are initially marinated for 24 hours with a coating of spice, which is made mainly with star anise, obviously, but cinnamon, cumin, and a little bit of chili. The meat is therefore coated, and a day after, just seared and cooked in water with a number of vegetables. And once the meat is ready to be pulled off the bone, it's hand-pulled and put together, mixed with some of the gravy from the cooking juice, into some croquettes. It's a very different flavour. We used to croquette, meaty croquette exists, but this brings a slight Asian taste to something which is pretty, pretty British.
Yeah. Can I have one?
Of course, please. And tell us what you think.
It's right. Additional to the
fans. Oh. I should have one too.
Yeah. I think it's marvellous.
It's not overwhelming, is it?
Certainly not. I think if you were to eat this, if you're the sort of person who just eats your food, you'd enjoy it because it tastes nice. If you analyse your food, you might spot that there's...
But that's the nice thing about layers of different spices that we quite like doing and mixing things. So cumin, for example, is an Indian spice, but it seems to work well here.
Is the anise overpowering in this?
Certainly not. Because it's there, but it's... And I must say the meat, I think the slow cooking's worked really well.
Yes, it does, hasn't it?
And it's fantastic.
It's lovely because it's not fatty. Fat literally all has fallen off. So it's a lean, obviously now it's fatty because we've made croquettes out of it and fried them, but the meat itself is just beautifully tender. And so aside from the beef, you know, things that you can poach, you can also poach fish. So white fish such as cod would work beautifully with a star anise in the stock and some cinnamon and rice wine, say ginger and garlic. And we've often done that and served with some steamed vegetables and rice as a healthy dish. And for sweet dishes, one thing that we like to do is poaching rhubarb, forced rhubarb, particularly the pink colour, beautiful, with some orange juice, cinnamon, ginger and star anise in the liquid. And then we can
I've done rhubarb. In fact, I frequently do rhubarb with ginger and orange, but I've never used star anise with it, so I shall give it a go.
Also, pears will work well in the same way, and then you could obviously combine that into...
It's a good flavour combination with quite a varied range of things, isn't it?
Absolutely.
I mean, from meat to pears, it's quite a big jump.
Well, savoury to sweet.
This is a coconut, desiccated coconut egg white butter made into a tweel, and I'd added half a pod of star anise. So it is perhaps a touch on the strong side. Again, we're just recipe testing for our supper club. I'm going to be thinking about serving something like that with this sorbet, which is a clementine and jasmine sorbet that we've made. Apologies, it's melting a bit now. But just so you can get an idea of the flavours. Again, this is totally made up and just now. So.
And this is the supper club?
This is one we've got on...
The beginning of February?
Yes. Yes.
Wow, these are tremendous. And again, you can taste it. But it helps somehow, doesn't it?
It enhances the flavour.
Yeah. So it's big in Chinese food. And I think after this it will become bigger in Cambridge cuisine.
I hope so. We got these from Alamein on Mill Road and widely available in other spice shops. And I only started using this fairly recently. In the last year and a half we've started using it regularly. But even, say, in gingerbread and other sweet baking or in cakes. It's a lovely winter spice to combine with cinnamon and ginger.
I'm surprised you can have it with fish. It enhances the fish as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a nice... And in fact, it's a Heston Blumenthal recipe where he does salmon with a black licorice-type gel, obviously, in his usual complicated way. But this is... And again, that might be slightly stronger, but this is... if you use it as a pod whole... in the poaching liquid, it'll just be very subtle.
Yeah.
In general, for fish, you would think about dill or fennel to bring the anise flavour, and this is just another range of flavour that you can bring still into the same range of anise. It's just a bit stronger, so you need to measure it carefully so it doesn't overpower your fish, but alongside dill, fennel, this is in the same family. So if I can talk very quickly about those croquettes they made with oxtail and beef brisket, which are initially marinated for 24 hours with a coating of spice, which he made mainly with star anise, obviously, but cinnamon, cumin, and a little bit of chili. The meat is therefore coated, and a day after, just seared and cooked in water with a number of vegetables. And once the meat is ready to be pulled off the bone, it's hand-pulled and put together, mixed with some of the gravy from the cooking juice, into some croquettes. It's a very different flavour. We used to croquette, meaty croquette exists, but this brings a slight Asian taste to something which is pretty, pretty British.
Yeah. Can I have one?
Of course, please. And tell us what you think.
It's right. Additional to that, we
can.
I think it's marvellous.
It's not overwhelming, is it?
Certainly not. I think if you were to eat this, if you're the sort of person who just eats your food, you'd enjoy it because it tastes nice. If you analyse your food, you might spot that there's...
But that's the nice thing about layers of different spices that we quite like doing and mixing things. So cumin, for example, is an Indian spice, but it seems to work well here.
Is the anise overpowering in this?
Certainly not.
Because
it's there, but it's...
And I must say the meat is, I think the slow cooking's worked really well.
Yes, it
has,
hasn't it?
Yeah,
and,
it's fantastic.
It's lovely because it's not fatty. In fact, literally all has fallen off.
Mm.
So it's a lean, obviously now it's fatty because we've made croquettes out of it and fried them, but the meat itself is just beautifully tender and... So aside from the beef, you know, things that you can poach, you can also poach fish. So white fish such as cod would like work beautifully with a star anise in the stock and some cinnamon and rice wine, say ginger and garlic. And we've often done that and served with some steamed vegetables and rice as a healthy dish. And for sweet dishes, one thing that we like to do is poaching rhubarb, forced rhubarb, particularly the pink colour, beautiful, with some orange juice, cinnamon, ginger and star anise in,
yes,
in the liquid. And then we can
I've done rhubarb, in fact, I frequently do rhubarb with ginger and orange, but I've never used star anise with it, so I shall
give it a go tomorrow. Also, pears will work well in the same way, and then you could obviously combine that into...
So it's a good flavour combination with quite a varied range of things, isn't it?
Absolutely.
I mean, from meat to pears, it's quite a big jump.
Yeah. Well, savoury to sweet.
This is a coconut, desiccated coconut egg white butter made into a tweel. And I'd added half a pod of star anise, so it is perhaps a touch on the strong side. Again, we're just recipe testing for our supper club.
Mm.
I'm going to be thinking about serving something like that with this sorbet, which is a clementine and jasmine sorbet that we've made. Apologies, it's melting a bit now, but just so you can get an idea of the flavours.
Wow, these are tremendous. And again, you can taste it, but it helps somehow, doesn't it?
It enhances the flavour.
Yeah. So it's big in Chinese food, and I think after this it'll become bigger in Cambridge cuisine.
I hope so. We got these from Al Amin on Mill Road, and widely available in other spice shops. And I only started using this fairly recently. In the last year and a half, we've started using it regularly. But even say in gingerbread and other sweet baking or in cakes, it's a lovely winter spice to combine with cinnamon and ginger.
Mm. I'm surprised you can have it with fish. It enhances the fish as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a nice... And in fact, it's a Heston Blumenthal recipe where he does salmon with a black licorice-type gel, obviously, in his usual complicated way. But this is... And again, that might be slightly stronger, but this is... if you use it as a pod whole in the poaching liquid, it'll just be very subtle.
Yeah.
In general, for fish, you would think about dill or fennel to bring the anisey flavour. And this is just another range of flavour that you can bring still into the same range of anise. It's just a bit stronger, so you need to measure it carefully so it doesn't overpower your fish. But alongside dill, fennel, this is in the same family.
And that was Nazim and Pierre from Franglais Kitchen, and they'll be back with us in a month's time.
Wine is good, but the right wine with the right food is even better. So Tom Lewis is here to talk about this. Tom, is there a fixed set of rules for matching food and wine?
Well, I tend to think of it more as an art than a science. I think there's some underlying principles and conventions that you need to adhere to, but within those there are no fixed rules.
Well, there used to be a sort of fixed rule about red wine and fish. What about that?
I think that's quite an old one, and I guess it probably dates back to a time when if you had a red wine, it would have been a chunky claret, and if you were having fish, it would have been a delicate piece of sole in butter. I think we've moved on a bit in gastronomic terms since those days.
Yeah, okay. So the old rules don't, well, necessarily apply anymore, but is there still an idea of classic matches?
I think classic matches is a good starting point. It's a base from which you can learn and then experiment.
So you'd include things like what? Goats, cheese and Sancerre, red, Burgundy and game, Chianti and beef, Rioja and roast lamb?
I think those are all great examples of classics. They've stood the test of time because they work as matches. And if we look at why they match, then we can start to apply the principles.
Mm.
If you take something like goat's cheese, it's sharp, creamy, it's slightly pungent. So a wine with plenty of acidity and good aromatics will match to that, and that's why Sancerre works. If you look at Chianti, it's quite high in tannins and acidity, so it's going to cut through a rich piece of beef really well.
Right, so there are fundamental principles, and really we need to master those.
Yes, I think there are certain things that do match. There are tannins and protein, high acidity in the food and wine. And then there are certain things that will always clash. Tannins just don't work with too much salt or with too much bitter spice. And the other thing is the food mustn't be sweeter than the wine. So if you take these ideas, then you can say that you shouldn't have a tannic red, for example, with spicy Asian or Middle Eastern foods. If they're well seasoned and they have chilies and maybe some sweetness as well, they're going to clash.
Okay, but what about spiciness in a wine?
Yeah, well, some reds, and especially something like a Syrah from the Rhone, will be distinctly spicy. And I think that will work if you've got a hint of spice in the food. If you, say, go for something like a game stew with pepper and cloves. But a full-on curry, I think, is going to be too much.
Yeah, okay. So that's why, off-dry wines like Gewürztraminer are often suggested as a match for spicy Asian foods.
I think if there's some sweetness in the food, then you definitely need an off-dry wine to go with it. So that's the basis behind that idea. And a Gewürztraminer has quite strong flavours. It's got enough body to stand up to a spicy dish. And the sweetness in it is going to match both with the saltiness and with the bitter chili spice.
Well, salty and sweet, that's another basic principle, isn't it? As in salted caramel. But what about red wine matches generally?
Well, when you're looking at red wines, I think what defines them most is their tannins.
And they're the mouth-drying sensation that you get when you drink them.
Yes, there are tannins in tea. So if you think of that mouth-drying feeling you get from drinking very strong black tea, that's what they are. They work well with protein and fat. So a tannic red is going to be best matched to a piece of roast red meat.
And what sort of wines do you have in mind here?
For a big tannic red, I'm thinking of something like a Bordeaux, a Chianti or Rioja. And if you think more in terms of grape varieties, then something like a Cabernet, a Tempranillo or a Syrah.
And are there generally foods that are easy to match with wines and, well, wines that are easy to match with foods? What would you say to that?
I think in both cases you're looking for a certain degree of versatility. The sorts of things that will match well with each other mustn't have too much of their own outgoing personality. Otherwise, they risk becoming a bit like an over-effusive party guest. They're entertaining, but a little bit overpowering.
Right. And who wants that? Right. Right. Well, Tom, Restaurant 22 in Chesterton Road was talking on Twitter yesterday, I think, about a dish, pansotti with fennel, ricotta, endive, walnut sauce. Now, that seems pretty tricky to me. What would you suggest for that?
A wine to match to that. You've got aromatics, you've got sharpness, you've got some bitterness in there. So there's quite a lot going on, and you probably don't want too expressive a wine.
You want something versatile.
Versatility, right. Exactly. So I keep it local, and I go for something quite versatile. I think a Verdicchio from northern Italy. It should be rich and leasy with just some lemony savouriness. I think that would match perfectly.
Right. Okay. Well, they have their own ideas, so we'll find out what they think too. Well, thanks, Tom, and you're coming back in 2 weeks' time to sort of round off this whole area of food.
Absolutely,
and wine.
Yes.
Brilliant. Thanks.
Okay, we go over to some food and drink news now. Let's begin with pop-ups and supper clubs. On the 13th and 14th of February, Urban Street Kings will be at the Alexander Arms, in Guido Street, and there will be 6 courses for £30. And you can go to their website for details.
Another Valentine's Do, the Fine Art of Dining, is doing a 14-course meal in Newnham on the 14th and 15th of February. Cost appears to be £75. Book via the Fine Art of Dining website. They are also doing a night in Bodisham on the 8th of March. If you've seen it as the 9th of March, that's an error apparently. It will cost £25 plus a booking fee. More info on their website. The menu is really very interesting.
Frongley Kitchen, who we heard from just before, is having a night of North African cuisine with a French influence. That's on the 1st of March and I shall be there. The suggested donation is £30 and it's at a central Cambridge location.
Deepa Mystery is hosting an evening of vegetarian Gujarati food, which I bet will be really tasty, and that's on the 22nd of February at 7:30 and costs £32. Find out more at foodmela.co.uk, and that's foodmela.co.uk.
The Guider Street Farmers Market is coming. We've talked about this some months ago. It's on the 2nd of March and it's in the car park.
Now, if you're running a supper club, do let us know via email. That's flavour@cambridge105.fm. Or you can send a tweet to @flavour105 and that will do just as nicely.
There's a beer festival on currently at the Portland Arms and one at the Hopbine as well. They finish on Monday.
And a new cafe. It's opening at the old Donaldson's Bakery at 82 Mill Road. It will be run by the Garden Cafe of the Botanic Garden fame. There's a lot of interest in it already. No firm opening date yet, so we will let you know.
There are some good courses coming up soon. At Sticky Beaks in Hobson Street, Hilary Caccio is doing a hip and healthy vegetarian evening on the 27th of February. And on the 13th of February, she has an Italian sourdough demo for beginners and those who would like to extend their repertoire. Both evenings are £35 for recipes and tasters. You book directly with Hilary, who you can email at hilaryjj@btinternet.com.
Ursula Ferrigno has several classes coming up at Sticky Beaks. On the 20th of February, La Dispensa, how to cook hearty home-from-work meals. On the 20th of March, she covers Italian Easter dishes, including an Italian Easter cake and Easter speciality pasta. Both courses are £35, including recipes and tasters. Book with Ursula. Her email address is rmoores6762@aol.com.
And finally, a couple of courses at Urban Larder. The Art of Working and Creating with Chocolate will take place on the 11th of February from 6:30 to 9:30, and that will cost you £40. Info is on the Urban Larder Facebook page. Also, Peter Vachol will be running his How to Make and Bake with Sourdough workshops, covering everything from making and feeding a starter, baking with it, adding flavour to it, and that will cost you £35. You can call Urban Larder to book, or you can email them. The first of several dates is the 25th of March, and tapas nights are starting at Urban Larder on Friday nights when the evenings begin to lighten up. And on that note, we come to the end of another edition of the programme.
Don't forget to follow Flavour on Twitter, at Flavour105. That's where we tweet Cambridge food and drink news. You can also find previous episodes on our podcast page, on the Cambridge 105 website, and now you can also find us on iTunes.
Coming up next is Saturday lunch, then at 2pm there's R Mill Road, 3pm In Your Company, and at 3:30 there's The Science Show with Roger Frost and Chris Creese. At 4 o'clock there's 2 hours of Sports Live with Max Wadsworth, and from 6 till 7 you can tune in to Jason Allen.
So thanks to all of our interviewees today, and until the 22nd of February, it's goodbye from Flavour.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.